Hi, this is Paul. I saw the Alex O'Connor video that he put out a little bit ago about Ayaan Hirsi Ali. And I'd watched the one that Genetically Modified Skeptic put out, and I'd seen the one that Rationality Rules put out, and they all basically said the same thing. One of the criticisms, of course, I've talked about the motivational criticism in a previous video that I've done before, but one of the things that they all come out with is Ayaan Hirsi Ali is a Christian for the wrong reasons, because the only reason to become a Christian is to because you've used reason, and somehow on the basis of reason you have determined that Christianity is true on the basis of reason. So I want to do a little bit of video about this assumption that they all seem to share, and whether or not it actually works, even by virtue of reason itself. Reason has a number of problems in and of itself, especially from a worldview that they all share. Ayaan Hirsi Ali doesn't offer her arguments for why her conversion is reasonable. She offers her arguments for why she thinks it's good and important and why it works for her. And for this, they criticize her. But sort of the assumption behind this idea about you just sort of sit out there and look over the menu of world religions and choose the one that's most reasonable. You immediately have a problem with human anthropology. I have never met a human being that I think actually does this. Now, I've met plenty of human beings that think they do that, but when I look at the rest of their lives are full of tastes and variabilities and styles and customs, and they're, in fact, live in the midst of all sorts of things that they have inherited that have shaped their idea of good, bad, right, and wrong, of what is reasonable and what is unreasonable. If, in fact, reason were such a powerful thing, then we would have people who sort of float above the earth, theoretically, not physically, and they would be the wealthiest people and the people for whom everything goes right because they somehow are using reason. Part of the problem with this, of course, is that if reason is just so absolutely great and is so obvious and easy to use, why doesn't everyone use it all the time because it always delivers such magnificent outcomes? And why are only sort of the smartest people or think themselves the smartest using it? And why don't they somehow look wonderful and great as compared to all the rest of us who just hear about it and say, what exactly do you mean? Now, if you ask them to demonstrate the validity of this supposed reason, they will point to science or technology or a bunch of things like that. And as I've mentioned in previous videos, science and technology have indeed produced a great number of really wonderful things. Science, within fairly limited strictures, can give us knowledge about whole ranges of things, but the deliverables, they can't really deliver on everything our heart desires. Because then again, suddenly we would see two classes of people in the world, those who are reasonable and those for some unknown reason are not reasonable, and those two groups should be easily distinguishable. People will point to clear things like, let's say, the electrolysis of water. You pass an electrical current through water and voila, you get hydrogen and oxygen. Isn't that cool? You learned that in high school chemistry. And reason and science are very good with that kind of thing. But very quickly, when you use reason and science, you begin to discover that there actually are a limited number of things for which this really works well. And all of those things are, in fact, contextual. The subset that all of this is based on is limited, and people act like, well, surely, if only we had access to all the information, if only we had access to all of the cause and effect relationships, if only we had access to everything that we would need to make the decision, then we would make the reasonable decision. But this is very much an act of faith. Because number one, a la combinatorial explosiveness, you are not going to have access to all the information. And you can sort of wait until you do, but you'll be standing next to the Christians waiting for the second coming of Jesus Christ. And a la combinatorial explosiveness, which seems to be known pretty much by science and observation, I think you have less hope than the second coming of Jesus Christ to actually arrive there, and you're certainly never going to get there in terms of your own lifetime. Now, you might imagine that C.S. Lewis talks in The Abolition of Man that humanity must be preserved, but we'll talk about that duty problem later. You can only demonstrate that for a certain number of things, the knowledge that we gain is good enough to do other things. That's something that the pragmatist at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century came up with, but it has significant limits, and if you don't know these limits, well, why don't you just have a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a dog, or a child, or a parent, and use your reason upon them and see how far you get. In most cases, you don't get very far. So in other words, reason doesn't really square real well with the kind of human anthropology we actually find out there in the world. Now, I am not going to dismiss reason completely because I think Christians, in fact, have good reason for reason and have far more reason for reason than non-Christians. And in the Jordan Peterson, John Lennox conversation, I think they bore this out. This experience or this process or this thing that you employ that you call reason, which sometimes does and sometimes doesn't, deliver on the reasonable expectations that you might have, why do you think the world is intelligible? Reason can't tell you that the world is intelligible. Reason can tell you that some things of the world can be wielded and employed and used, but always within contexts, and we simply don't have that much control over a lot of these contexts. Christians, however, believe that the world is reasonable because there is, in fact, a reasonable God who has built reason into the world, and that's why the world is intelligible at all, and that's why our abilities to use reason actually work in the world. An atheist says, well, the world is just a product of chance and chaos and no reasonable mind. Is there any reason to believe that reason should work in the world at all? Or that reason, as we practice it, isn't just some very limited post hoc justification that we tend to use.
So, and there's no getting, see, and what the atheist materialists would like to do is to say, well, the world of facts speaks for itself. But that's also technically untrue because there's an infinite number of facts. They're certainly not all relevant. We can drown in the plethora of facts, and we certainly will do that. And to even communicate about them or study them, or even draw our attention to them, we have to prioritize and hierarchically arrange the facts.
And of course, the manipulation of these facts, the finding of these facts, the employing of these facts, the wielding of these facts, well, it only works again if you just sort of have limited contexts and limited subsets. And what in fact we have as a culture is a scientific lab leak, because we see, oh wow, we can make oxygen and hydrogen from water, therefore we can learn everything from reason and deliver for ourselves the world we want, even though we haven't done that.
Do that according to an ethic, and I think that is incontrovertible on scientific grounds, because we have seen the emergent realization in a whole variety of domains, AI not least, that there are facts, but those facts have to be prioritized. And you prioritize facts with an ethic.
That's absolutely right. There's a deeper problem, it seems to me, with the atheist understanding of science. And that is this, that we do the science with our minds. Some people think the mind and the brain are the same. I leave that aside, since you're an expert on the mind and the brain. But I often say to people, you know, what do you do science with? I've asked many leading scientists this. They say, well, I do it with my mind and my brain. Give me a brief account of the brain. And they say to me, well, the brain is the end product of a mindless, unguided process. And I pause and I look them straight in the eye and I smile and I say, and you trust it? Tell me honestly, if you knew that the computer you use or the machinery you use in the lab was the end product of a mindless, unguided process, would you trust it? And the interesting thing, I've done a lot of experiments with this little story, and I've always got the answer, no, I would not. So I say, you have a problem. In other words, your atheism is undermining the very rationality you use, not only to do science, but to construct any argument whatsoever. It's not only shooting itself in the foot, it's worse, it's shooting itself in the brain.
Let me ask.
Now, you'll hear Peterson often talk about logos, and part of what's behind that is this idea that, in fact, built into nature is order, predictability, that yields our capacity, and built into us as image bearers of God, yields the capacity to actually have the kind of dominion over nature that the beginning of Genesis says that we are given. We can apprehend that order with some degree of productivity. And we have duty to someone and duty to something. And we'll talk about the duty problem, which Chad the Alcoholic made a fun video about when I talked about it with Cale Zeldin. We'll talk about the duty problem a little bit later. The first thing is that we sort of have the dogma problem. I often hear these individuals that love calling ourselves apes, the fact that all of us apes seem to develop dogma. And for many of us, dogma in certain contexts isn't terribly evident. But as enlightenment, the spirit of the Enlightenment continues to recede, it's sort of like this lake over in Eastern California. This is one of the spots I love to take my children to when they were still living at home. We would go to Mono Lake, and you go to this lake, and there's these huge tufa, they call them, these huge tufa things standing out of the lake, and it's full of brine shrimp, and it's a very salty lake. Well, why are these things standing out of the lake? Well, it's because local and regional people have taken diverted water from the streams that used to feed the lake. The lake was kind of a dead end. And with all of the minerals in the lake, that all of these formations just happened. And then when they stopped allowing these streams to feed the lake level went down, exposing these formations. And I think part of what we're seeing with the recession of the spirit of the Enlightenment, this is what we're seeing. We're seeing dogmas revealed from this group. And again, one of these dogmas is this supposed duty to rationality that they're trying to impose on Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Well, she has this duty to rationality. Well, tell me from your worldview where you construct this duty. No, this is their dogma. And they believe that this is a universal dogma. It applies to everyone. And it's an unchangeable dogma. It applies to everyone and everything at every time. Can you demonstrate the rationality of this dogma? No, but there it is, this dogma. So they complain about Christian unchanging dogma. Well, this is a dogma of their own. But again, why should we bow to this dogma? Can you answer that? I don't think so. Ayaan Hirsi Ali must have reasons. Ayaan Hirsi Ali must make certain claims to qualify for her status as Christians. They themselves now sitting in the chair of deciding who can qualify to use that identity or not. Dogmas are tags that we use to identify people and their system. Everybody has them. Dogmas are universal. If you're going to think in this world, you're going to have to construct the sacred. You're going to have to figure out what is sacred, and by those things, you will judge the rest of the world. It's kind of like the frame problem. A second issue with reason is the fact that, again, it doesn't really work. Christian Smith, in writing the book, The Bible Made Impossible, Christian Smith is actually a Christian who works at Notre Dame, or at least used to work at Notre Dame University. Why Biblicism is Not a Truly Evangelical Reading of the Bible, talked about pervasive interpretive pluralism. And atheists have long pointed out to Christians, as if Christians didn't know this, Christians can't agree on what the Bible says. Often, in sort of an atheistic worldview, they imagine that the Bible is some algorithm that Christians are supposed to use. Well, the Bible really isn't anything quite like that. The Bible has narrative, the Bible has poetry, the Bible has laws. There's a long history of interpreting the Bible, and Christians squabble and fight over how the Bible should be interpreted. That's kind of what a living community does. And so that pervasive interpretive pluralism, Christians admit, this is true of us. Reason seems to have the same interpretative pluralism problem. You have all of these people out there espousing reason, and sort of the mechanistic, calculating way they think reason should behave, you would think they would all agree on all kinds of things. But they seem to be just like all the other human beings and have all the same differences and fights and squabbles that Christians have and just about everybody else has. It doesn't work as it's sold to work. Where's the last time you heard a debate work? Everybody comes in and they're going to have this big debate about reason, and most of the people that leave the debate kind of leave with most of the big ideas that they came into the debate with. Maybe a few ideas changed, and sometimes they do that little survey thing. But for the most part, reason doesn't work as advertised. It never seems to. It's sold to be something that is like a mathematical calculation, and it just doesn't work that way. Now, reason works the way Christians say it works. What about that? Well, it's human anthropology. People are not calculation machines. They are complex, nuanced, fallible creatures with multiple conflicting motivations. We try our best to be reasonable, but we don't always do so sometimes. We have status to worry about. We have relationships to worry about. We have opinions and biases to deal with. We employ reason sometimes to a degree, but we're really not very good at it. And actually, a tiny little minority of people think, well, that's really the most important thing that we should do. If people worked by reason, why would we be in the messes that we are in? In other words, if you imagine that reason is somehow king, you have to also explain, why don't people use it more? Why are people so unreasonable? Why am I so unreasonable as to make this video? Why do we have to admonish, bully, shame, browbeat people into it? That undermines its own anthropology. Human behavior seems to not undermine a Christian anthropology at all. Big in this, I think, is Ian McGilchrist's observation about the right brain and the left brain. Now, I am not a cognitive scientist or someone who studies the hemispheres of the brain. I will leave that to those people to decide if this, in fact, correlates physically to the brain. But I think his arguments in terms of our shared mind are pretty clear. There's a way of proceeding that seems very left-brained that looks sort of like this looks. Well, we're going to organize everything, we're going to manage everything, we're going to nail everything down, and that side of the brain has these aspirations that maybe we can do this and we can construct for ourselves a tower that reaches up to heaven. The other side of the brain, or the other side of the mind, or however you want to construct it, says, probably not. Probably not, because that doesn't seem to be the way anything works around here. And you can consult Ian McGilchrist for the rest of his argumentation. I made a comment in the question and answer today, and I don't mean anything against individuals here, but there's it's sort of like an autism. It's sort of like a savant nature. And I have known a number of people on the spectrum, or even people who have some pretty dramatic savant abilities. And it seems to be that they have difficulty with open-ended things, like usually other people, because other people are about the most complex thing you're going to imagine. And all of your vaunted reason usually breaks down very quickly when you're having an argument with your girlfriend or your boyfriend. People imagine, no, it should just work this way. Yeah, but it doesn't. The world is too complex. The world is too big. And at least one mind or one side of the mind seems to have a handle on that and seems to actually do better with that, while the other just wants everything to be simple and straightforward and logical, and it always falls apart. That's why I call it the scientific lab leak. The whole world doesn't work like electrolysis of water yielding oxygen and hydrogen. And then there's the duty crisis. And I really came about this in listening to this video with Constantine Kissin on trigonometry and Francis's last name, and Sarah Hyder. Now, I played most of this before, but I'm going to play some of this because she notices this in looking around, thinking about her worldview and comparing it to the religious.
And Sarah, let's wrap this up in a slightly interesting way, because you mentioned being an atheist. When I was probably 18, 20, I found that way of thinking very appealing. Now I'm agnostic, and I think that's likely where I'm going to stay. But you hear a lot of people talk about the fact that, and I have some sympathy with this argument, that the decreasing religiousness of the West has allowed things like wokeness to step into that void. Mm-hmm. What do you as an atheist make of that argument?
I think it's an interesting argument, yeah. And makes me very uncomfortable.
I can imagine.
But yeah, I think there's, it's fascinating and adds a complication to, you know, what I would as an atheist prefer to think and, yeah. and and be true about the world and human nature, really, and how we optimize for the best kind of society. I would prefer that a society in which there's no religion, mm-hmm. You know, and also somehow we have solved for dogma, you know, the dogma that might come in other forms. I think that's the best society of all.
Sure.
But is that a possible society?
Probably not.
Is it possible for us to not have religious dogma and to also somehow resist every other kind of dogma? Is that a possible world? So from that perspective, you know, a secular but religious, does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
World is in some ways worse, you know, the worst of all, you know, possible outcomes, you know, maybe even as bad as ancient, you know, religious contexts. So that's, I think that's a very interesting train of thought. I'm not sure where I end up there at the moment. I do think that there is a psychological need, I think, for the comfort of some kind of transcendental values, you know. I think they can be routed in other ways. I don't think you need God, but I think you need them to be bigger than you. And you need it to be something that draws you into the collective, into people around you, and something that gives you this sense of belonging and personal significance, but also, and this is a word that doesn't get used enough, duty towards others, you know? Like, not just that I belong here and you make me feel great and personally significant, that's wonderful, but also, what do you owe them? What do you owe your fellow man? I think that idea of duty is what is a cornerstone of communities, you know? And we're seeing the fraying of communities all over the Western world.
So aren't you and I, isn't this our fault?
A little bit, maybe, yeah. Insofar as we can't find something else, insofar as that we can't address this problem in some other creative way. But ultimately, I think this is where modernity is going. This is the path that we're walking down. Sort of alienation from each other, from the physical world, from broader, the world around us, our neighbors, that kind of thing, we're increasingly alienated from. And that's a modernity challenge. Can you bring religion back and say that this is the solution? I don't know. I don't know if you can force yourself to believe something that is, you know, not true. I don't think I could. I think that even if I thought religion was very good, I don't think I could go back to it.
Well, this is what...
So this duty problem, because you need duty, seem to relate to one another and sacrifice for one another, and part of the difficulty of this nihilism means people don't. And when people don't, and when people don't on a large scale, it becomes a problem. And so how are you going to make them? That gets scary. I think most atheists take basically the duties within Christianity and use that sort of intergenerational and just have it flow through, but when people no longer have those, and as each successive generation it sort of breaks down, it's hard to see how reason sort of steps in and replaces it. Apes seem to want what they want. And in the end, that might not be terribly good for the community of apes. And for me, always the biggest point in this is there seems to be no duty if in fact there is no real meaning and there is no real purpose. And if that is the case, well, where does this really go? And why should I care? Nihilism gives no duty to not live in a fantasy world. You know, if it seems to work for me, why not? Where's the duty that I be reasonable and rational? Now, one might say, to the degree that reason and rationality helps me navigate a world that at least has good enough order around me, well, then I'll, you know, avoid pain. But, oh, that's true, and I think that's pretty much how many people live. They use whatever reason or rationality they have at their disposal to get what they want or avoid pain or that. But what about after my death? What about successive generations? Well, maybe I look at my children and I sort of imagine my grandchildren, but there's so many things that can come in and just wipe them out. Why should I sacrifice for the future?
Christianity. But at least now she says she has another reason to be Christian, not just that of finding an effective way to combat our political foes. What is this reason? I have also turned to Christianity because I ultimately found life without any spiritual solace unendurable, indeed very nearly self-destructive. Atheism.
Now, again, if you look at the Unheard interview with her, she's very serious about this. She was undergoing a meaning crisis. She was in the depths of what I saw with how many people when Jordan Peterson sort of break out, nihilism-induced depression. And so for her, basically, the argument was, hey, if really there is no God and we are just the product of physics and chemistry and blind evolution, why not be a Christian? The universe doesn't seem to care. And my neighbors would celebrate it, at least most of my neighbors, except for these people that feel a little hurt or maybe pinched because Christians seem to score a point in this sort of game of one-upmanship around them. Why not be a Christian if the world is empty, especially because I'm suffering from depression here, and we should probably just play what she said.
A lot of people were also questioning what appeared to be a more of a sort of practical way of making your faith decisions. That was very discussed. I mean, the article has been read many hundreds of thousands of times already since Friday, and no doubt will continue to be. But I did notice that as a common response, which is, it felt like a justification or a discussion of Christianity as a mechanism to resist cultural collapse, almost. Mm-hmm. And there was not so much of a personal journey, not so much about your own faith. Is there anything that you would expand on there?
So the reason why I care, first of all, you have, you know, a limit on the number of words that you want to publish.
Yeah.
On her. and I'm expanding this into a book, but yes, there's a very personal story. I don't know to what extent it's useful, but on a very personal level, I went through a period of crisis, very personal crisis of fear, anxiety, depression. I went to the best therapists money can pay. I think they gave me an explanation of some of the things that I was struggling with, but I continued to have this big spiritual hall or need, as you call it. I tried to self-medicate. I tried to sedate myself. I drank enough alcohol you could use to sterilize a hospital. It would not, nothing helped. I continued to read, you know, books on psychiatry and the brain, and none of that helped. All of that explained a small piece of the puzzle, but there was still something that I was missing. And then I think it was one therapist who said to me early this year, I think, Ayan, you're spiritually bankrupt. And at that point, I was in a place where I had sort of given up hope. I was in this place of darkness, and I thought, well, what the hell? I'm going to open myself to that and see, you know, ask her, what are you talking about? Mm. And we started talking about faith and a belief in God, and I explained to her that the God I grew up with was a horror show. He created you to punish you and frightened you, and, you know, as a girl and as a woman, you're just a piece of trash. And so I said to her, I explained to her why I didn't believe in God, and more than that, why I actually hated God. And then she asked me to design my own God. And she said, if you had the power to, you know, attribute a higher power, if you had the power to make your own God, what would you do? And as I was going on, I thought, yeah, right. That's actually a description of Jesus Christ and Christianity at its best. And so instead of inventing yet another new God, I started diving into that story. And so far, you know, my husband and I went about, both of us saying we're atheists, and now it's, I like this story, I exploit, and the more I look at it, the more, I don't want to say I'm fulfilled, but I feel I no longer have this need, this void, I have to say, and I feel like I'm going somewhere. There are standards that I have to live by that are quite high, and that's daunting. But these are standards that I'd rather aspire to and fail. Maybe the only human being who nearly achieved that was the late Queen Elizabeth. But trying to emulate her is this daily practice of hardship.
Well, she never did interviews, so makes it easier.
Yeah. But that's, you know, service and duty and selflessness and check your urges and your impulses and your anger and your resentment and your pride. I find these things much more appealing than go and convert the others and if they refuse.
How should those of us who are...
Did she sound unreasonable? There it was, duty, meaning, something to aspire to. It all makes sense within that story. And I don't think the other story gives it as well.
Atheism failed to answer a simple question. What is the meaning and purpose of life? This is perhaps a more familiar sentiment. Turning to religion as an escape hatch from nihilism is a common story, though I must say one which might help the atheist establish his case. Atheists must account for the existence and prevalence of...
So your goal is to establish a case. Her goal is to live. Her goal is to thrive. You want to sort of, the world of reason. She's trying to drink herself to get death, and you want her to fill out a form.
Of religious belief. And one popular explanation is that religion is a social system invented to provide comfort to a planet of confused apes trying to make sense of the senseless and accidental fact of their own existence.
What if, in fact, we held apes? I don't mean sort of playing this little linguistic trick about humans being apes, but real apes to this. Does any of this really make any sense?
And nothing more. This thesis is, of course, quite difficult to prove, but accounts of people converting to theism explicitly because life without it feels devoid of meaning hardly counts against it. Ayan writes that atheism failed to answer what is the meaning and purpose of life. But it sounds more like she's decided that it did answer the question, just that it answered it with a resounding nothing. And, unable to accept this, she felt attracted to Christianity. But maybe not.
And so the idea is that, and I hear this all the time, well, reasonable atheists are courageous. They boldly go into the world, and they forego, we need no meaning. There is nothing there. Here we go. Well, why go at all? If there is no meaning, if there is no duty, if there's none of this, then why not, again, do nothing? Why make videos? It just all falls apart. C.S. Lewis dealt with all of this in The Abolition of Man. First of all, he might say that the real value lay in the utility of such sacrifice to the community. There's your duty. Good. He might say, means what is useful to the community. But of course, the death of the community is not useful to the community, only the death of some of its members. What is really meant is that the death of some men is useful to other men. What is really meant is that the death of some men is useful to other men. That is very true. But on what ground are some men being asked to die for the benefit of others? Every appeal to pride, honor, shame, or love is excluded by the hypothesis. to use these would be to return to sentiment, and the innovator's task is, having cut all that away, to explain to men in terms of pure reasoning why they will be well advised to die that others may live. He may say, unless some of us risk death, all of us are certain to die. But that will be true only in a limited number of cases. And even when it is true, provokes the very reasonable counter question, why should I be one of those to take the risk? At this point, the innovator may well ask why, after all, selfishness should be more rational or intelligent than altruism. The question is welcome. But if by reason we mean the process actually employed by Gaius and Titius when engaged in debunking, that is, the connecting of inference of propositions ultimately derived from sense data with further propositions, then the answer must be that a refusal to sacrifice oneself is no more rational than consent to do so, and no less rational. Neither choice is rational or irrational at all. From the propositions about the fact alone, no practical conclusion can be drawn. This will preserve society cannot lead to do this, except by the mediation of society ought to be preserved. This will cost you your life, cannot lead directly to do this, do not do this. It can lead only through the felt desire or acknowledged duty of self-preservation. The innovator is trying to get a conclusion in the imperative mood out of premises in the indicative mood. And although he continues trying to all eternity, he cannot concede, for the thing is impossible. We must therefore either extend the word reason to include that our ancestors called practical reason and confessed judgments such as society ought to be preserved, though they cannot support themselves by no reason of the sort that Gaius and Titius demands, are not mere sentiments, but are rationality itself, or else we must give up at once forever, the attempt to find a core of rational value behind all the sentiments we have debunked. So Ayaan Hirsi Ali had obviously found herself in a mental emotional corner that the therapists and the doctors couldn't deliver her from. And so she tried going on an adventure with the truth. And she said, well, it seemed like, is it the truth? She didn't know, but she was going to try it. So what does she do? She starts asking questions, even though she's not being hunted, or maybe she would be, but she's not being hunted down like she was before, and she's not being sort of backed into a corner like she was before. She's living in one of the best places in the world to live, and I can attest to that because it's Northern California where I live. And she really wants the truth, and she's willing to seek it.
In a world which is comfortable, and we have created buildings in which there are heavy things that you pick up and put down in the same place because it's simply so rare that you have to pick up heavy things.
It's called a gym, and you pay to go there. And I think many people in the world would look at us and think, I remember thinking about when I was a missionary in the Dominican Republic, thinking about jogging and how I'm working with people who are really struggling to get enough calories in, and North Americans are just expending themselves on the roadways, running to go nowhere. It's a crazy life we live here, but the meaning crisis is ours.
Right,
right, right. The proliferation. We have speed bumps on our roads for the same reason.
Proliferation of ice baths and sauna, and even reading to some extent. You know, difficult things. Where should people go, given that they are in a world which is more comfortable than ever before? Where should they go to encourage them to find difficult
truth?
Now, if you're one of these atheists, you've got it made. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to make YouTube videos complaining about a woman who was obviously in crisis and has found a better way. You don't have to do any of these things. Well, truth. But again, the apes in the jungles care not for truth. They don't care for much of anything. We worry about their existence more than they do. But there's an adventure of seeking the truth.
Truth is what's optimally difficult. The truth is optimally difficult. It's a really wonderful thing to know. The truth is adventure. There's no distinction. Partly because if you're going to just say what you believe to be true, you have to let go of the consequences. You can't predict the consequences. Well, there's no difference between not being able to predict the consequences and having an adventure. They're the same thing, right?
Because if you knew the consequences, it wouldn't be an adventure.
It's not an adventure if the consequences are foregone.
The same as it's no sacrifice or courage if there's no risk.
Right, right, right. It's exactly the same. And so it's a wonderful thing to know that optimized adventure is to be had in the truth. Think in every given situation. So Christ says in the Sermon on the Mount that to orient yourself properly, and it's often viewed as this hippie pan, take no thought of the morrow will take care of itself. You know, God takes care of the sparrows, he'll certainly take care of you. It's like a hippie wet dream. That isn't the core of the message. The core of the message is very straightforward. Christ says, aim up to the highest thing you can possibly imagine. So that's the relationship with God. You put what?
Now, so often, now Jordan in this interview often quotes the Sermon on the Mount. And the thing that I often find when Jordan is working with the Bible is that he makes excellent points, but he's often making excellent points, not necessarily to the text that he's pointing to. And I'd say, well, point to this other text, seek first the kingdom of God and all these things will be added to you. That's Jesus' admonition. And that's exactly what Jordan is saying right here.
What's at the pinnacle, properly at the pinnacle, and you aim at that. And then you concentrate that, and it's that, and treating other people like you would like to be treated yourself. That sets the moral frame. Then you attend to the day and the cares of the day. It's like once you've established the proper moral frame, you pay attention to the day and you live in truth. And that moves you towards that destination. You have to have the orientation right. You have to be aiming up. But then it's just a matter of, what would you say? Abiding by the truth. That's the logos that sets people free. And
doing
that's
it,
right.
Doing it properly. Right? There was one of the other rules that didn't make it into your book. Nothing well done is insignificant.
Mm-hmm. Right, 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 right. Yeah, well, you accrue. So Christ tells his followers in the Gospels to store up treasure in heaven, not in the places that moths can eat and rust can destroy. Well, what is that? What is meant by that? Well, it's meant by the same, it means the same thing that you just pointed to, which is that if you run yourself through a disciplinary process, so you accomplish something, maybe it doesn't, you don't attain the goal you were aiming at, but you accrue a new way of looking at the world and a set of skills. Well, if you just keep doing that, you have multiple ways of looking at the world and more skill. Well, that's your storehouse of treasure. You know, the reason women use wealth as a proxy for attractiveness is because wealth is a proxy for competence. It's not competence because you can be rich and useless. Now, it's not that easy, but it can at least happen temporarily. But women use markers of wealth to assess competence. And the competence is the treasure, not the wealth. Because if you're competent, you could be thrown into the desert and you'll make it bloom.
I've said this about people that go to the gym. So from the outside, someone that goes to the gym and has got a good body or whatever, there's the body, and this is what you get to touch during sex when you're intimate, right? But the story that someone who has a good body tells you about the sort of person that they are is much more important, I think, than the way that it manifests physically. It's someone who is reliable, who is able to overcome hard things,
who is
self-disciplined.
Disciplined. Yeah, it's a marker for discipline.
It's just this whole big, long laundry list of things. They're able to deal with pain and discomfort, which is kind of sexy in a way.
It's the perfect...
One of the interesting things about this in terms of women and competency and people who go to the gym, again, it's not sort of this calculation. Now, there's rationality in that. There's purpose behind it, but it's not just sort of this logic chopping to figure out what to do. And when I listen to Ayaan Hirsi Ali, Before, she was nihilistic. Now, she has an adventure. She has a sense of duty. There's someplace she's going. She's looking into the story. She's got questions. She doesn't know how the thing will go, but she has reason to believe that she's on a better path. And they're sort of your choice. You can sort of be smug and self-satisfied that you think you're smarter than everyone else. You can't really explain why all these other people are unreasonable and you somehow have been benefited by reason. And you can't explain why, despite all of the reason that you have been blessed with, you aren't somehow outperforming everyone in the world, when in fact, 100% of us get eaten by the age of decay. And reason or not, you've got the genetic makeup you have, and I dare believe Ray Kurzweil will, in fact, not make the singularity. That's just the way it goes. So, yeah, calling ourselves apes, I don't see that that's an upgrade. Calling ourselves ape and then lauding reason when I'm just unimpressed. I'm far more impressed, far more inspired by what the rest seem to be doing. So, I had misgivings about this video. Sat on it for a few days. You know, I talked to Kale on Wednesday. Said, oh, this is the video I want to make this afternoon. Was all excited about it Wednesday morning, but then had all those conversations and sort of lost my nerve and then made a PowerPoint and thought, I don't know if I like this either. And even starting the video, it's like, I don't like conflict that much. But aim up. Tell the truth. And when it comes to the truth, I just don't think that worldview fits. And I like the worldview that I inherited and that I've chosen to follow. And although I do so imperfectly, when I listen to her talk about where she's at now, and I listen to these other guys just kind of smug and self-satisfied, it's like I'd rather spend time with her. I'd rather be more like her, because that's an adventure that seems worth pursuing. And truth be told, if the nihilists are right, they have no reason to tell me not to pursue my preferences. It's utterly reasonable. So, anyway, if you've gotten to this point in the video, congratulations, you've reached its end. And leave a comment. I'm sure many of you have clicked away by now, but I YouTube just tells us how many people actually make it to the end. So, blessed are you. Leave a comment.